Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show, friends. Happy to have you here as always. Had a little break there for the Thanksgiving holiday and a few other things, and still got a backlog of podcasts. If you're a podcast listener, they're going to be coming out fast and furious here pretty soon, or really have been by the time you get to this one. We got a great show coming up for you here today. Want to have been very excited about since we got it on the calendar. We are talking with Richard Mason. Richard is an author, lecturer, wine consultant, and recently penned, I believe it's his third book, The Wines of Portugal. And as you may guess, Richard is an expert on all things Portuguese wine. That includes Madeira and Port. And this is a truly excellent book. Gives you a good bit of history about the wine industry in Portugal. It also talks a little bit about the contemporary landscape. And then it becomes a guidebook. Talks about varietals, talks about terroir, and then highlights a whole bunch of excellent producers in that country. It's highly, highly recommended to check for you to check that out. I enjoyed reading it. And one of the reasons why I was so excited about it, my last name is Dias, D-I-A-S, as you know, and I'm part Portuguese. My grandfather on my dad's side immigrated from Portugal in the early 20th century, and I've always had an affinity for Portuguese wine. So it was really exciting. The first show we've ever done talking about the wines of Portugal. So really great stuff with Richard. I will note too that, you know, really noted guy. He has contributed to the Portuguese sections for the Oxford Companion to Wine, LaRousse Encyclopedia of Wine, the World Atlas of Wine. He writes for Decanter. He writes for other magazines, and he also is the chair for the Port and Madeira panel for the prestigious Decanter's World Wine Awards. So a lot of really interesting stuff there. Richard's a great guy. He's actually coming to us. We did this over Zoom all the way up and over there in Sheffield, England. So yeah, that's our featured interview today. Stick around. We'll learn about some Portuguese wines. Want to mention that next week, our show, we're kind of continuing the theme with wine authors. We're going to be chatting with Jessica Dupuy, who recently published a book on the wines of the Southwest United States. So we don't mean California or, you know, obviously Oregon or Washington. We're talking about Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado. And there's a lot of really cool up-and-coming things happening in those parts of the world as it relates to wine. Texas, we've talked about it on the show before a long time ago. You know, they've, after 20, 25 years of winemaking, seriously winemaking, they found their footing and they're growing what they're supposed to grow and things like that. So really excited to talk to Jessica just about those wine regions and her fine new book that just came out as well. A little bit of programming action here for you, some programming notes. We are going to, after we do the show with Jessica on the Wines of Southwest, we're going to take another break. Yep, being kind of lazy, but take another break here with new shows for the holidays, and we will be back with new shows after the first of the year. We do this every year because I just want a little downtime, you know? Got to get caught up on these podcasts, some of these other things, take care of some other stuff, but we're going to have some exciting changes and some new things going on with the show in the new year, and we'll have some more news about some other stuff going on a little bit further into the new year, so a lot of things to work on and get in order. So there you go. One more new show, friends, before we take a holiday break. We're going to take a brief pause here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends, and then we're going to be back chatting with Richard Mason, author of The Wines of Portugal. Come on back.
Well, my book has got a hole in it. My book has got a hole in it. My book has got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer.
Brought to you by the St. Rock Market, a local food hall featuring 12 unique food and beverage entrepreneurs serving globally inspired meals from barbecue platters to Mediterranean cuisine. Located at 2381 St. Claude Avenue, the St. Rock Market is open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, dinner, coffee, and cocktails. We offer online ordering, curbside pickup, and both indoor and patio dining. Learn more at strockmarket.com.
Drinking wine for the old man. Drinking wine for the old man. Drinking wine for the old man. Pass that bottle to me. Wine, 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 elderberry. Wine, 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 potent sherry. Wine, 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 blackberry. Wine, 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 red cherry. Wine, 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 oh boy. Wine, wine, wine. Well, my grandma was to hold a go. She listening on the radio. Feet got it happy and she grabbed the dress. The first
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. Happy to have you here. And as you know, we are chatting with our featured guest, noted wine lecturer, writer, and consultant. I ran down some of the fine publications that he contributes to, Richard Mason. Richard, welcome to the show. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us all the way over there in Northern England. It's almost wine time for you later in the afternoon as we record this, and I can start early if I need to here.
You can. There's a saying, you know, if you don't have one at 11, you have to have 11 at one.
Exactly. Perfect. And I want to ask you this, Richard, because I ran down some of the publications that you contribute to regularly, some of the books, and as well as your own books. And we'll get into your latest publication as well as your other stuff a little bit later on, The Wines of Portugal, which is the principal part of our conversation here. But I was reading something in your bio. I speak Spanish better than I speak Portuguese, even though I'm of Portuguese descent. But I'm seeing that in 1999, you were anointed a Cavaleiro of the Confraria do Vinho do Porto, which I'm not 100% sure what that means, but I'm thinking it means like Knight of Wine, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a sort of knighthood that you get in a recognition of your contribution to promoting port and port wines and Douro wines as well.
That's fantastic. Does that get you any sort of special access to anything, the keys to the car, as it were?
It would be nice, no, but I have good access. And I've got a lot of good friends in the Douro Valley, and they give me access to information and good wines as well. So I'm constantly writing up their wines for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have an extensive background with the wines of Portugal and authoring three publications now. Four publications, is that right?
Books? Something like that, a lot count, yes.
Three or four books. And your current book, which is Wines of Portugal, which is really excellent. And we'll get into that a little further about the book, because it's got great narrative in it. It's a wonderful guidebook as well to the varietals, the regions, and so much more. But your childhood connection is fascinating as it relates to the country. And you were just telling me before we went on the air that your wife hails from Madeira. But tell us a little bit about how, as a kid, you found yourself with an affinity towards Portugal.
Well, it's interesting. Our family come from the north of England, and they were textile producers in Manchester and Liverpool. And of course, there was a textile link with the north of Portugal. And I think, if I remember correctly, because this is going back a long way now, this is going back before the revolution in Portugal, we were buying raw cotton from the Portuguese colonies through Portugal, and then spinning it in the north of England. And so my first trip to Portugal was a sort of holiday combined with a business trip. And we went by sea in those days. It's funny to think of that now, but we docked under what was then the Ponte Salazar, the main bridge in Lisbon. And I remember very well, I was 9 years old, I remember thinking, this is the place for me. And so it has been for the rest of my life. I've been going backwards and forwards ever since then. That was 1971. And of course, my wife comes from Madeira. I met her through... I knew her family first. I met her through wine, through a wine tasting, and her family are wine producers in Madeira, Blandy family. So the wine is sort of, wine flows in the blood now in our family, particularly Portuguese wines. And I suppose the taking the story a little bit further, the interest in wine started because I had a gap year between school and going to university here in the UK. And I went out to Portugal for a year, and I was given a job in a restaurant, you know, just serving behind the bar and that sort of thing. But the owners of the restaurant, who were an English couple, gave me responsibility for the wine list. Hmm. I knew nothing at all about wine, as you don't when you're age 18. You've drunk it, but you don't know anything about where it comes from, what it's all about, and so on. So I thought, I better learn a bit about this as being sort of being dutiful in my job. And so I went up to Lisbon, bought a couple of books on wine. There weren't very many at the time on Portuguese wines, one on port and one on Portuguese wines. And sat there on my afternoons off on the beach reading about wine, thinking this is really quite interesting. This is something that really appeals.
Did you... go ahead. Please continue.
Keep going.
Well, so Richard, you mentioned something about how there were not a lot of resources and information on the wines of Portugal at the time that you were discovering this stuff. And that's largely a function, correct, of the political landscape at the time in the country and the way that affected the wine industry?
Absolutely. This was in 1979. So the revolution had happened in 1974. And Portugal was thrown into, for a year in 74, 75, into complete turmoil. And by 1979, the economy, I think, was probably about at its lowest ebb. Things had really fallen apart. The revolution had had its impact. There had been no investment in the economy, no investment in the infrastructure, roads. It was a difficult country to live in at the time, and a very difficult country for people running businesses. And Portugal had shed its colonies by that time. And the colonies had been the biggest market for wine. Huge volumes of wine, cheap wine, had gone out to Angola and Mozambique. By 1979, there was a lot of wine without a market there. And there wasn't much focus on quality either. Going back a bit further to the sort of 1950s and 1960s, the pre-revolution Salazar regime had formed cooperatives all over the country to try and really try and break the cycle of Portugal's subsistence economy. There were so many small, tiny producers just making wines in their own back rooms for their own consumption, really, or for the consumption of their neighbours. So to try and break that, they formed these cooperatives. And the cooperatives, I suppose, at the time were as up-to-date as they could be. But due to bad management, lack of investment, and so on, by the 1970s, these cooperatives were really, they'd really had it. And the wine that was coming out was in vast quantity, or large quantities, and pretty undrinkable, certainly not fit for export. And so something had to change. And it began changing, I suppose, when Portugal began changing at a faster pace anyway, when Portugal joined the European Union in 1986. And that had a huge impact. Suddenly, in the late 80s, the money came in, the investment came in. Some of the co-ops transformed themselves, some didn't, and some fell by the wayside. But it brought money in for individual growers, some of the larger growers, to start making their own wines rather than selling grapes to cooperatives themselves. So there was a big transformation that took place at that time, and we're still reaping the benefits of that now. And indeed, some of the cooperatives have survived and gone on and are very strong. Others, including the one that was the largest in the country back then, has collapsed and is no longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's brought quite a bit of hardship on some of the smaller growers as a result.
Now, is it fair to say, Richard, that prior to this time that, and you mentioned this, that people were growing a lot of bulk wine, which is quantity over quality. So yeah. It's pretty fair to say that I think people were not necessarily growing what they should grow. They were growing what they thought they were supposed to grow, meaning poor varietal selection in the wrong places, using the land to produce quality wine. It was just sort of a bulk exercise in agriculture.
Absolutely. The cooperatives on the whole made no selection of grape varieties. They paid on volume of grapes rather than the intrinsic quality of the grapes. So there was no incentive for growers to plant better varieties. And indeed, some of the varieties that had been developed by the government in the 1960s were varieties that were developed specially for volume rather than any quality. And Portugal's terroir, which had existed, had been lost by that time. An awful lot of it had been lost. You have a region like Douro, for example, which is now re-emerging as one of Portugal's leading wine regions, and indeed was one of Portugal's leading wine regions back in the early part of the 20th century. And that the Douro region was entirely in the hands of the cooperatives. It was forbidden to produce, to make wine other than through the cooperative. So all the vineyards, all the producers sold their grapes to the cooperative. They had to by law, and then the cooperatives then sold the wine on to either merchants or sold it themselves. And so the region was completely lost, and it was very frustrating to see that. Even when I was relatively young, I started out in the wine trade after leaving university in 1984, and were visiting vineyards around the world and so on. And you could see the potential in Portugal, in parts of Portugal, but just seeing it just wasn't being realized. And you wanted to knock a few heads together and say, you know, this is what can be done. And the EU has done that largely by bringing money in, by improving the legislation, the old cartels that existed that were the legacy of the Salazar regime pre-revolution were broken apart, creating a much freer market for wine. And it's been quite a long time coming, the transformation, but the transformation is there now, and will continue for years to come.
Richard, were people during this time that you're talking about, the Portuguese themselves, because I mean, wine's always been a part of the culture at the family table. Were people just kind of resigned to the fact that they're drinking swill, or were there pockets where locally people were kind of doing a little better for what they were drinking themselves?
There were always pockets of good wine around. There were always those producers. And there was a category of wine, which has largely disappeared now, called Garrafeira, which was a peculiar Portuguese category, where merchant firms who would scour the country sourcing good quality wine or grapes from and bottle it as their Garrafeira, their reserve wine. Garrafeira means private cellar or private reserve.
Okay.
And those wines were, some of those were outstanding, really outstanding. But there was no, quite a lot of them had no appellation to them. There was no knowing where they came from. And one Garrafeira from one year, from one same company, maybe from a different place entirely from the next year. There was the concept of terroir was largely lost by that process. So, bad wines. But don't forget also that Portugal really didn't have, until the European Union came along, Portugal had a very small middle class.
Mm-hmm, right.
The urban middle class who were demanding of quality really only began to grow in the sort of post-revolutionary period in the 80s on, from the 80s onwards. And that middle class, of course, has been much more demanding of better quality wine.
Okay, excellent. And so basically with these co-ops and what we were seeing, it almost reminds me, Richard, mirroring under a greatly different set of circumstances, but mirroring the South African wine experience, where these co-ops dominate, farmers grow, grapes show up at the co-op, and then nobody knows really where they end up from there.
Yeah, and I found the same thing. I went to Romania just after the revolution in Romania. I found exactly the same sort of situation there with grapes growing in the wrong place, wrong varieties and so on and so forth. And it takes time to transform that. And that's what's been going on over the last 20, 30 years in Portugal.
So they've
literally been rediscovering their terroir.
Great. And that also very much reminds me of, right, the South African story as well, where they're, as you very well put it, don't really need to say any more than rediscovering the terroir. We got a couple minutes, Richard, before we take a break. So just hearkening back to your story. So then you took over the wine list there at the restaurant. Let me fast forward ahead a little bit, because you actually owned a vineyard, correct?
That's right. Something I always wanted to do. I bought a vineyard in the region of the Alentejo, in the northern part of the Alentejo, I've always really liked, a place called Porto Alegre. And the beauty of the region is that it's higher altitude. So it's in southern Portugal, but it's much higher altitude. So you get higher rainfall, slightly cooler temperatures, not the sort of burning heat that you get in parts of southern Portugal inland. And I had 15 years of making wine there, which I enjoyed to a point, but it stretched me both financially and in time as well. And it coincided with a sort of very difficult period of my life, of children growing up and children at school here in the UK, and so I sold it 2 years ago. But I've gained a lot of experience from it and enjoyed it as well.
That's really interesting. So were you a hands-on winemaker yourself, or was somebody doing the winemaking for you?
I had a business partner who was a winemaker who knew stuff, a good winemaker, a chap called Rui Ginga, who knew the area well. We worked together for, say, 15 years on this project. And it's now I've sold it now to Sograp, who are Portugal's largest winemakers. You may know that they produce one of Portugal's leading wines, Barca Velha, under the Ferreirinha label. And their object is to produce the Barca Velha of the Alentejo, which I wish them luck doing, because I think it's a great spot. And I have to say, with this year particularly, with all the problems there have been with traveling and COVID, I have to say I'm quite grateful I sold it when I did, because trying to run a vineyard from remotely was difficult anyway, and to do it this year without, would have been impossible.
Right.
But I enjoyed the time I did with it, and I learned a lot from it.
That's fantastic. Really interesting. Richard, we're going to take a little break here, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about wine in Portugal, and we're going to talk about the aptly named book, The Wines of Portugal, which you have recently penned as well. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. We'll be right back.
The Mayhaw is the craft cocktail bar located in the historic St. Rock Market. Join us every day for happy hour from 4 to 7 p.m. and weekly specials like Tiki Tuesdays, Whiskey Wednesdays, and Thrifty Thursdays. The Mayhaw offers local craft brews and a robust and ethically sourced wine selection for enjoyment with your meal on the patio or for carryout. The Mayhaw is excited to present Mayhaw Mobile, a cocktail, beer, and wine delivery service. Learn more at strochmarket.com.
I wonder why my baby drinks so much wine. If she keeps a drinking, she's gonna lose her mind. She's a wine head.
All right,
woman,
welcome back to the program.
Know.
Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. We are chatting with Richard Mason, a wine expert and author, talking about the wines of Portugal. And Richard is up there in northern England. So as we record this, you're a few hours ahead. And we were just talking about, tell us what's in your glass right now, Richard, because I'm jealous and curious at the same time.
I thought I'd just pour a glass of a wine called Carcavelos. It's a fortified wine from the outskirts of Lisbon. It's a wine that was very popular in the 18th century. And it was popularized, in fact, by Portugal's prime minister at that time, the Marquês de Pombal, who was the first person to demarcate a wine region. He demarcated the Douro region to protect it from wines coming in from outside. And this is a wine, it's a fortified wine made from white grapes. A mixture of all sorts of different white grapes there. And it almost went into extinction about a decade and a half ago. And as the vineyards were built over and sold off and so on, and rather sadly, but thank goodness the government has stepped in now and put some money behind a producer there, the local council, in fact, the local authority have stepped in. And they're making now a really good fortified wine once again in small quantities, Carcavelos. Delicious it is too.
That sounds terrific. I mean, I'm kind of seeing that you can see a little bit of an oxidative note on there. Maybe I'm looking through video on Zoom, so I don't want to give too much of a read on the color from afar.
It's delicious. It's a 2005 that would have been bottled a year or two ago. So it would have had at least 10 years in wood. So you get that oxidative character in there. So it sort of behaves a bit more like a Madeira. Which means actually this bottle, which has been on ullage for some months now, actually, it hasn't suffered. The wine is still in good nick and has a lovely sort of freshness to it and acidity to it, which belies its fairly warm where it comes from in a fairly warm region. But the grapes have natural acidity, and it's close to the Atlantic. I think probably the Marquês de Pombal would be very proud of the wine that they're making now. Going back. If you could bring him back from the middle of the 18th century,
got it. Excellent. I'm guessing maybe some of the Portuguese would not necessarily want him to come back, right? But
he upset the port shippers greatly.
Yeah, right. Read the book; you'll understand what I'm talking about there. Well, Richard, since we're on the subject. We're here in the United States recording. That's where a lot of our audience is. Other people are hearing it outside the borders of this country. But, you know, a lot of people aren't necessarily all that familiar with Portuguese wine. So I was thinking maybe we could touch on the terroir briefly here and then touch on some of the key varietals that people may and styles. I don't want to say varietals, but styles that people might want to look for.
No, of course. Portugal is a small country. It's only about 100 miles wide, and it's a narrow strip down the Atlantic coast. People tend to think of it, certainly Europeans tend to think of it, as a Mediterranean country, partly because people go on holiday to the Algarve, which is sort of on the southern bit and has a more Mediterranean climate. But actually, Portugal is very strongly influenced by the Atlantic. And that influence diminishes quite sharply as you go inland across that 100 miles. So by the time you get 100 miles or so inland, you've got a continental climate. Whereas on the coast, you've got this very much strongly Atlantic climate, high rainfall, mild summers, warm summers and mild winters. Whereas inland, you find you've got hot summers and quite cold winters. So this creates, along, of course, with the geology of the country, and I can go into that as well, but this creates a huge variety of different terroirs, which are really just being rediscovered now, as I said earlier on. And I suppose starting in the northwest of the country, the largest demarcated region in Portugal is the Vinho Verde region, the green wine region. And it's called green wine, not because it's colored green. It can be either red or white, which was always a bit of a surprise to people. But because it's fresh, it's to be served young. And in the old days, restaurant wine lists used to make a distinction in Portugal between what was called green wine, vinho verde, and vinho maduro, mature wine. And that was the distinction. But vinho verde, like so many regions, has come a long way in rediscovering its terroir and grape varieties in recent years, and matching those grape varieties to different terroir. And it's again within a region that there's a huge numbers of different sort of micro meso climates there. And there's some fabulous wines coming out of there. So one of the grape varieties to look out for is one of the few grape varieties shared by Spain is Alvarinho. You've probably come across as Alvarinho in Galicia. Mm-hmm. In Portugal, it's called Alvarinho, which has been planted now increasingly widely in Portugal. And it's a grape variety that really works in the sort of pocket of the very north of the Vinho Verde region, the towns of Monção and Melgaço, where you've got some fabulous wines coming out of there, that sort of lovely, with lovely crunchy apple characters and floral honeysuckle characters coming from the jasmine coming off the nose.
Firm acidity, right, also because of the...
Yeah. And perfect with shellfish. Portugal's fish is famous, and so you can go to these sort of beachside restaurants north of Oporto and eat some of the finest fish in the world, matched by what I think are some of the finest wines in the world as well. Alvarinho is a wonderful variety, but it's not just Alvarinho. There's great varieties like Loureiro, which is an interesting variety that's come out on its own now. It tends to produce a lighter, more minerally wine, but beautiful, can have a really steely, fresh, minerally quality to them. I know minerally is a word that's a bit overused now, but it really does have that sort of steely character from the coming off of the granite soils. Mm-hmm. Which dominate in the Vinho Verde region. And there's another variety called Trejadura, which go often blended with Loureiro to give it a bit more body. You've got Arinto, which is known as Padanã in that part of the world. These are all varieties which are really indigenous to Portugal and have been rediscovered now and are sold either as varietals or indeed as in blends.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, please.
No, I was just going to give you a sort of bit of a vintner's tour, because you've got Vinho Verde on the Atlantic coast, and adjoining it, literally abutting it, you've got the Douro region, which of course produces a wine completely the opposite to Vinho Verde. You've got these, you've got port wine, of course, which is big, heavy, rich, sweet wine, wonderful in its body and concentration. And the new breed of Douro wines, which are coming out of there from the same grapes as port, couldn't be more different. Yet the two regions join each other, and again, the region is, I suppose, the Douro was ahead of the other regions in a way because of port. You've got port shippers who'd invested in their vineyards there, but many of them thought that Douro wine was sort of for wimps, whereas port wine was for men. You know, and that was that attitude pervaded until relatively recently. In fact, still one or two port shippers still think a bit like that. But the Douro Valley is really emerging now as one of the great wine valleys of the world, not just for port, which of course has been recognized for centuries, but also for Douro wines made with these wonderful grape varieties, which are adapted, in that case, to these schistous soils there, as opposed to granite. And some fabulous varieties like Touriga Nacional, Touriga Franca, which have sort of become the Douro blend, the classic Douro blend, a bit like the Bordeaux blend, but other varieties too, which are being discovered and rediscovered in the region.
They're very distinct, and I think at least the ones that I've experienced to this point, and I think that's at least here in the New Orleans area and what I'm seeing around the United States more locally, that's kind of, especially the red wines in particular, that's where they seem to be dominating what we're seeing in wine shops and on wine lists.
Yes, red wines, certainly from the Douro, have been dominating things, but don't ignore the white wines as well, because again, I tasted a new white wine recently from Quinta do Noval, who of course are known for their ports, great ports. Quinta do Noval Nacional is one of the great ports of the world. I tasted a white wine from them recently, outstandingly good, really outstanding good. And again, it's a question of finding the matching the grapes to the right sites, going higher up in the region, so grape varieties being planted higher up at higher altitudes, picked earlier so that they retain their natural acidity, and all sorts of different methods of production now being used, including sort of barrel fermentation and so on and so forth. And getting that balance right, and that's the important thing, is getting that balance right. And quite a lot of trial and error has taken place to get there, but the port shippers themselves are getting there with these wines, red and whites. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Richard, let's take a little break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more, maybe hit on one more region, and then we're going to talk about your fine book, The Wines of Portugal. Friends, come on back.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans.
Brought to you by the St. Rock Market, a local food hall featuring 12 unique food and beverage entrepreneurs serving globally inspired meals from barbecue platters to Mediterranean cuisine. Located at 2381 St. Claude Avenue, the St. Rock Market is open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, dinner, coffee, and cocktails. We offer online ordering, curbside pickup, and both indoor and patio dining. Learn more at strockmarket.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are chatting with a Portuguese wine expert, Richard Mason. And Richard, you were just running down some of the, we're kind of highlighting, we're cherry picking, as it were, a few regions to discuss. What you're sticking around for the podcast only segment, Another Shot with Nola Drinks. We're going to get into more detail, but let's pick one region for a couple minutes here further to the south that we want to know.
Well, we started off in the north with Vinha Verde and the Douro, and as in complete contrast, certainly to Vinha Verde, is the Alentejo region, which is a huge area south and east of Lisbon, a huge rolling plain, and you get some pretty extreme temperatures when you get away from the Atlantic there, but it does border the Atlantic as well, and interestingly, that's an area that it is currently being planted, but it's a fascinating part of the world. It's an area where, unlike the north of Portugal, you've got this extreme fragmentation of holdings. So you've got these very small vineyards, which economically aren't very efficient. In southern Portugal, you've got the opposite. You've got very large land holdings and much larger vineyards, and therefore lower unit costs down there. And of course, irrigation is now possible through much of the region. But there's one little pocket of the Alentejo, which is close to my heart. It's where I had my vineyard, and that's the Porto Alegre region in the north, which is a sort of transition between north and south. It's part of the Alentejo, but it's mountainous. And you've got granite and schistous soils there, and capable of making some wonderful wines. It's a lovely part of the world. It's almost been forgotten until very recently. And something that I've helped to do, I think, with my own vineyard there is put the place on the map. Others may benefit from it now, but I don't mind that. It's all good for Portugal and so on. And so, it's another sort of small terroir in what is a big area of the Alentejo, which is being identified and discovered for red and for white wines. Don't ignore the whites from there as well.
Terrific. Let's talk about the book, Richard, here, while we have seven or so minutes left. Wonderful publication. It's your, I think, your third or fourth book, like we were talking about. And it's new, right, this year. And The Wines of Portugal. And strangely, like we were talking about this before, when you were a younger man, there wasn't a whole lot of information out there. This book seems to really fill a void, actually, still to this day, and fills a niche that was lacking for information on wines of Portugal.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really aware of that when I first started my first job in the Algarve in Portugal, how little information there was available. And the problem was also when I first started writing about Portuguese wines, and that was back in the 1980s, so it's some way back, how little information was forthcoming from the authorities at that time. And there were very few statistics. The authorities, a lot of the farmers themselves, didn't even know what they had growing in their vineyards. Mm. It was a tradition in Portugal that you would have grape varieties all sort of muddled up together. And you'd ask a grower, well, what have you got here? And he said, well, I might have a bit of this, and I think there's a bit of that, but my grandfather planted that, and so on. And you couldn't be specific about things at all. And people were quite coy about things. So, I mean, we're trying to get the information for my first book, which was published in the early 90s, was really difficult. And there was very little information on grape varieties, even though there was a fascinating treasure trove of varieties there waiting to be unlocked. And as the years have gone on and people have the trend towards batch planting rather than the sort of old pick and mix that you used to get, a lot more information has come out about grape varieties. And of course, I've gleaned some information myself from my own vineyard with my own varieties, how they've performed and so on. I don't think all the information is there by any stretch of the imagination at the moment. I think there's plenty more varieties to be discovered or rediscovered, matching them to the right place. And so there'll be future editions of this book, which will bring things up to date, hopefully. But what I like about the book and what I've enjoyed doing most about it is bringing the relevant history into it to explain where things are today. Because that's quite important. Sometimes history gets forgotten, and people sort of look at wines as a sort of snapshot of where we are now. And with a country like Portugal, where you've got a history which goes back a very long way, I think it's quite important there that every region has its own distinct history, and every producer, including some producers who sort of have a history going back 200 or 300 years in some cases, that history is quite important to explain where they are today. And why they're making the wines they're doing today. And so there's a lot of that in the book, as well as the sort of snapshot of wines, of where things are now. What I've tried to avoid doing is putting tasting notes in this book, because, of course, from one year to the next, wines change, new blends come along, new things are made, and the book quickly goes out of date. That's what the internet's for nowadays. right. Which wasn't there when I wrote my first book. I've tried to give more of a sort of guide to the style of wines, rather than give a sort of snapshot of this is this wine. It's very good now, because you know next year that could be different. Year after that, different again, and so on. So
that's a great point, and I think that speaks really well to the larger wine world, because I find that especially now. When you look at the global landscape of who's making what, it's very difficult. I mean, blind tasting is just, it gets harder by the day because of the way people continue to change how they grow, what they grow, different techniques are introduced. People bring different stylistic approaches, and I'm assuming that Portugal is no different.
Yeah, exactly that. So I've included, there are so many producers now in Portugal. I couldn't include them all in one book. The book would have been double the length. And in fact, my publishers had maybe cut the length down anyway to, I think I'm just looking at it now, it's 356 pages, which was quite long enough. And so there it is. You've got the US edition. I've got the Portuguese edition, the English edition here, which is looks slightly different.
Oh, okay.
Is
that because you were kind to us and used the imperial system in here instead of metric?
I did or not, actually. Maybe they edited it for the US.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. What was I saying before that? I can't remember now.
Cut it down because there's just too many.
Oh, having cut it down, the number of producers. There are so many small producers now coming out in Portugal that I couldn't include them all. It's very frustrating. I had to cut some out. But I've included a list at the end of each section, a list of those producers to watch in future, which may well make their way into the book. But I've had to include sort of quite substantial chunks on which I wanted to include some of the producers who are historically important, to again talk about their history, the family history, background, and so on. So it explains where we are now, where we are today.
It's a really wonderful publication, Richard. And I find, in reading it, and I still have more to read, to be honest, getting through some of the producers and things like that. But you accomplish two or three things with it. One, you give a really good background on the history that, unfolds as wine always does, the history of the country itself, as well as, the wine, the industry, how it's changed and transformed. We've touched on some of that today. And then we move into varietals and regions and things that people should know. So it kind of goes from a narrative and history to being a guidebook. And I think like any good guidebook, as you were just saying, the idea is that it allows you to dip your toe in the water and then probably discover a bit more on your own what leads from that, because there's no way to, as you were just saying, to be complete or exhaustive with this.
Absolutely. No, you can almost guide yourself around the country with this. And I've wound the history of the country, the political history of the country, which had been quite turbulent during the 20th century, into the history of the wines and so on. And explains, as I say, a lot of where we are today with things. But the Portugal's terroir is quite complicated, and certainly the north of country is very fragmented in terms of the land holdings, as I explained. So I've grouped the regions to make it easier into four sections. You've got Atlantic wines, those regions that are influenced by the Atlantic. You've got the wines of the mountains, those are the northern inland in the mountains of northern Portugal. You've got wines of the plains in the south, mostly the Alentejo and the Ribatejo, or Tejo as it's known now, down in the south. And the wines of the islands, which you mustn't ignore, because although the islands, Madeira and the Azores, are thought of as being producing fortified wines. Increasingly now, with the volcanic soils there and the fashion for volcanic wines from volcanic soils, there's a lot of experimentation, trial and error going on, producing wines from the traditional varieties there, mostly white varieties, to make some fascinating dry white wines from there as well.
I don't want to cut you off here, Richard, because we got to close the portion of the radio show. Really quickly, tell people the book can be had on Amazon, and very soon you'll be able to get it on your website, which is Richard Mason.
www.richardmason.com, that's right. You'll find lots of tasting notes on my website as well, from wines I've tasted in there. And you can have signed copies from my own website when it finally gets up, when it's working properly.
Beautiful. Okay, great. And this will all be linked in the show notes, friends, and we'll link to Richard's social media as well. Richard, you're going to stick around for another shot with Nolan Drinks. We're going to talk a little bit more about the wines of Portugal. But if you are listening on the radio, friends, I do appreciate it. Remember, now more than ever, be kind to one another. As always, use your turn signal. And until next time... Cheers, y'all. Everybody, hey, yep, another shot with Nolan Drinks. Thanks for sticking around, friends. Happy to have you here on this show. What an interesting conversation with Richard Mason, author of The Wines of Portugal and other fine publications. We're going to continue our conversation with Richard in just a moment. A quick note that you're probably getting tired of hearing me say. This show is another one that we held, the podcast version of the show anyway. It aired on radio a couple times in December of 2020, but the podcast version coming out just now, we held that because we wanted these shows, this last batch of shows, as you know, if you listen regularly, to be part of the relaunch of the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, which is, of course, part of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. You can find out more about it at southernfood.org. Well, we're going to bounce right back to our conversation with Richard, and then after that, I'll be back to close things out. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. We are chatting with Richard Mason, as you know, who is an expert in Portuguese wines up there near Sheffield in northern England. And Richard, you were just telling me also that you're the pro-chancellor at the University of Sheffield. What does a pro-chancellor do? We don't use that term here, as far as I know.
Pro-chancellor, we have a council, which is the ultimate responsible for running the university. And the council is populated by academics and by lay people, non-academics. And I'm one of the non-academics, although I was a student at the university way back when. And pro-chancellor basically is sort of below the chancellor of the university, who is effectively the president, if you like. But we're not actually vice presidents. That's the pro-vice chancellors. We call them vice presidents now. The pro-chancellors are lay people who ensure good governance of the university.
So a board of trustees, maybe, I guess, would be a similar. Yeah. Okay, got it, yeah. Got it. Okay, wonderful. So, Richard, we were talking about your book, The Wines of Portugal, and we'll circle back to that again, just to remind people where they can get the book that we just talked about a moment ago. But talking a little bit further about the current landscape in Portugal with the wine industry, we talked about the transformative experience that was the European Union modernizing, rediscovering terroir, which I think was a great point. I think it mirrors a lot of places that we talked about. But there were some interesting things that you touched on in the book, and one of the things that I thought was very fascinating is in the past handful of years, there's actually a considerable amount less growing area, less hectares of vineyard, but then there's been more stabilization and, as you put it, less boom and bust. So is that because people are kind of honing in on what they're supposed to do? It's more even keel. We just don't need as many hectares to produce good wine and produce consistency.
Yes, I think that there's been a real settling down of Portuguese agriculture in general in recent years. And the fact is that it's drink less but better is the motto really for Portugal, as it is for many countries at the moment. Some of those vineyards which produced large quantities of pretty ordinary wine that was exported to the, and some still goes there, to the ex-Portuguese colonies, Angola particularly, is still a big market. There's not nearly the volume that there used to be. And so people are retreating from the plains, if you like, the fertile soils on the alluvial soils and so on, particularly in the one region called the Tejo, named after the River Tagus, Tejo as it's known, and retreating to the hills, and looking for cooler climate as well. The whole climate change thing has been an issue for everybody in Portugal. And so it's made places like the place where I had my vineyard in the north of the Alentejo, at about sort of 700-800 meters above sea level. People are looking for those sort of areas now, cooler areas. It's benefited some areas. There's a region which I haven't spoken about before called Bairrada in the north of Portugal, just north of south of Porto, and that's an area which at one time you really found that you only had sort of two or three good years a decade. The rest of the time they were sort of miserable thin wines, largely because it was poured with rain at the wrong time. And the viticulture wasn't very good and so on, and a lot of the wine went into the sort of inexpensive rosés that Portugal's famous for, without mentioning any brand names. And so on, and the Bairrada region is transforming itself completely now, helped by climate change certainly, and improved viticulture. So Portugal really is, they really are rediscovering themselves and finding their way. There'll be casualties along the wayside. I don't think some of the small producers necessarily are sustainable in the long term, and there'll be mergers and acquisitions, but that's no bad thing. And I've seen Sograp, who are Portugal's largest winemaker and responsible for Matias Rosé, as I was inferring just now, which is a great product, by the way, a great product, and glows worldwide. But you know, they've been buying up small vineyards around, including my own, around Portugal. They've bought a vineyard recently in Bucelas, which is an interesting small enclave, nearly disappeared at one time, just near Lisbon, and is now coming back again with the Arinto grape, which is most at home there. So we're going to see a lot of changes and a lot of interesting things coming out, I think, as we go along.
Now, Richard, are we seeing, and we kind of, I think, pulled some of these threads together, but a point that you also make in the book is talking briefly anyway about some of the struggles that Portuguese wine still feel trying to get into some of the export markets. You touch on land fragmentation, which I think we've kind of touched on here, but if you want to elaborate on that, what are some of the barriers? We are seeing more Portuguese wine, especially in the States and in other export markets. It's a great value proposition. I think that's, you know, the changes in the way people craft their wine list these days. Good value for good quality opens the door for Portuguese wines. But what are some of the barriers, and what does the landscape look like moving forward to get the wines out of Portugal and into our mouths elsewhere?
Well, I think one of the problems is lots of the best Portuguese wines are only made in quite small quantities. And that's always going to be a problem because of the size of land holdings and so on. It's going to be a problem. So we're going to see quite a fragmented industry in Portugal, without necessarily the economies of scale. Portugal doesn't lend itself to volume production, really. Yields on the whole are low, particularly in south of Portugal, where you've got problems with rainfall and so on and so forth. So you've got naturally quite low yields. A lot of drought-resistant grape varieties, which are fantastic in the heat, can do very, very well there. But we're going to see, I think, new blends, new flavors coming out. We're seeing international grape varieties blended with Portuguese grape varieties in some regions, which is an interesting one as well. There's all sorts of things happening. I think also the other thing, I've mentioned this before in here, is the emergence of white wines from Portugal. People thought and even myself, I thought of Portugal as being a red wine country at one time. And it isn't. Portugal is capable of producing some really good white wines from interesting grape varieties. Things like Bical, which is a variety in the Beirada region, makes lovely wines with lovely taut acidity, fresh acidity there, and capable, they're age-worthy wines. There's so much coming out of Portugal still, and so many different grape varieties there as well. This treasure trove of grapes is gradually being unlocked.
One of the points that I want to make, Richard, because you and I were talking about this during the break, and kind of coming from a different angle, but most of the wines, or many of the wines, I should say, especially red wines, and I'm assuming to a degree white wines, they're blends. They're not single varietals typically. I think Alvarinho is probably an exception that we all know tends to be single varietal, right? As far as the way it's marketed and produced. Is Alvarinho used in a considerable amount of blends as well?
It's going into blends now because it's being planted more and more extensively around Portugal. And funny enough, I've had some quite good Alvarinho wines from the sort of deep south Alentejo region, where it seems to hang on to its acidity amazingly. But traditionally in Portugal, certainly red wines were always blends. And if you look at port, there's no such thing as varietal port, for example. They're all sort of quite finely tuned blends of different varieties. The only region in Portugal that was dominated by one variety, or I suppose there are two regions really that dominated by one variety, is the Beirada region, which was dominated by a grape variety called Baga. And even that now hasn't got isn't the dominant variety it was there. It's still important, but it's not overwhelmingly dominant. And then further south, you've got the Castelão grape, which was perhaps better known as Periquito at one time after a brand of wine, but is known as Castelão. And again, but otherwise, most Portuguese wines are blends. Red wines are blends. And the blends are greater than the sum of their parts. And I found that when I was farming, growing myself, we were growing the traditional grape varieties in our region, which was Trincadeira, Alicante Boucher, and Aragonês. And it was interesting to see those three varieties complement each other in a blend. Alicante Boucher is a variety, which is a variety which again was almost ignored in the rest of the world. It's a little bit in California, I think, coming around now.
There but is, yeah.
Grow all over southern France. Mm-hmm. Alicante Boucher has found its home in the Alentejo in Portugal, where it's been since the 19th century. Imported by an English family there. And is now being, it's very much a variety. Yes, you can find varietal Alicante Boucher on its own. It's interesting, but as a blend, it's fascinating. It's mm-hmm. fabulous.
Are we seeing? Is it fair to say that the majority of blends are going to introduce maybe 2 to 4 varietals as into the blend, or are there people doing sort of? We were talking about South Africa briefly before, so that's why this pops into my head, where you will have say 9. varietals or 11.
Yeah. Well, that can happen, and that certainly happened in the old days with vintage port, because you had these old vineyards which were interplanted, and you had all sorts of different grape varieties. You could find a sort of plot of vines with perhaps, taking an extreme case, 20 different grape varieties in that plot, and you wouldn't know necessarily what they were. That still happens with some of these old vineyards. There's a bit of sorting goes on now, chucking out the ones that don't look much good in there. But no, on the whole, now we're talking sort of 3 or 4 or 5 different grape varieties in their mainstream varieties.
Okay,
in these blends.
I have a friend of mine, maybe somebody that you might even know in passing, Jim Clark, who. He's the U.S. representative for Wines of South Africa for the government trade organization, and he makes his way to outside of this year, makes his way to New Orleans usually once a year and does a trade tasting. And you know, they're doing a much better job in South Africa these days. But he'll pour these white blends in particular that will have, I think, the high watermark was last year when there was one that had 11 different varietals in it. And I was joking with him because I said, "Man, that 1% of Peak Po really pops in the blend."
Well, I remember years ago talking to Marcel Guigal when I was in Cote Rôti, and I was asking him about the Viognier in there, and it was there was sort of 1 or 2% Viognier in a Cote Rôti alongside Syrah. He said, it's the salt in the cooking.
Okay, yeah, I mean, especially without those wines.
That was a very good way of putting it.
That works great. Well, let me ask you this last question, Richard, before you need to go to parent-teacher night here pretty quick, so we need to get you out the door. Okay. And you're properly prepared drinking wine for parent-teacher night, which is, I admire the preparation. Can you explain briefly to us, because, you know, we want people to explore Portuguese wines, of course, get your book, of course, because that'll be a great guidepost in which to do so, or from which to do so.
Well,
but the denominations, because, or appellations, as we'll call them here, everywhere is different. How do the appellations or denominations in Portugal work?
Well, it's ironic that Portugal, who produced the world's first denomination or first appellation in the Douro Valley back in 1756, was quite late into coming back to denominations again. It was only really after Portugal joined the European Union that they set about demarcating regions again. And that's been a bit of a problem for some regions, not all regions, but some regions, because some of the boundaries are political rather than respecting the terroir. So it tends to be, you've got traditional DOC regions like Vinha Verde, like the Douro, like Beirada region, with boundaries around them that have sort of a time-honoured now, if you like. But some of the regions in southern Portugal are perhaps more flexible in the sense that people blend across a wider area. And so you've got these, what the category of wines called Vinha Regional, regional wines, and often those are more important than the DOC category down there, and also they're more flexible in terms of the grape varieties you can use in your blends and so on and so forth. So there's a bit of work to be done still, I think, on Portugal's appellations, to use the French word. They're not all set in stone as yet. So certainly those in the south of Portugal, and I think a bit more respect needs to be played to terroir than has been so far.
There are different gradations though that generally exist, right? There's the controlled, protected, and then table wine. Is that?
Yes, okay. Exactly. It parallels the European Union system now in Portugal.
Yeah,
it's much the same. So it's much, the names might be different, but they're much the same as in France and Spain. But the same sort of ranking it takes place, but beware that, you know, the Vinha Regional cutter is like the Vin de Pays in France, basically.
Okay.
But it actually is accorded more importance in southern Portugal than the DOCs themselves. And you've got small DOCs like Bucelas, which I mentioned earlier, and Colares, which is a fascinating place, which have very tight boundaries around them, particularly Colares, which is thank goodness undergoing a revival. Colares was the only region in Portugal to survive phylloxera intact, because the vines are planted in sand and the sand protected the roots of the vines against phylloxera. Then the wines were costly to produce. They lost ground in the 1960s and 70s when a lot of ground was given over to building. And now the vineyards are coming back again, I'm pleased to see, and some great wines coming out of there.
Fantastic. I said that was going to be the last question. I am going to ask you one more question because I would be remiss if I did not do so. Richard, you mentioned that you spent your honeymoon in the Azores, which is the islands in the Atlantic, and that is where my paternal side of my family hails from originally. Give us maybe one or two little nuggets of information about I've seen a couple start to break into the market here in the States. So what should we be on the lookout for if you want to drink some island wine besides Madeira? No, don't want to diss Madeira at all, but.
No, Island of Pico is fascinating. The Island of Pico, which is quite a tiny remote island, but it's volcanic. Amazingly enough, although it's in the middle of the Atlantic, it's the highest point in Portugal. So it's higher than anything on the continent in Portugal. You've got this cone shaped volcano there. And you've got these fascinating World Heritage vineyards there, which are now accorded World Heritage status with these walled vineyards, walled to protect them for the Atlantic. And some potentially great wines coming out of there from indigenous grape varieties there. Again, keeping that sort of Atlantic theme with that lovely acidity that you get comes so well, and the grape varieties suit them well. And that sort of volcanic character comes with them, as you get from Madeira too.
Whites and reds in a lot of whites. That's why I've only tasted whites to this point. Okay.
Yeah. I think I'd say you struggle to ripen red grape varieties there. You'd have a few problems, I think. There are red grapes there, but you know, they tend to be a bit of an acquired taste.
Got it. That's a good way to put it. Well, and Richard, thank you very much. One of the things we were just talking about, the denominations and things like that, where there, you know, can be a little bit confusing. And then we're trying to unpack ways where people can explore and experience Portuguese wines. And I will reiterate this, that your book, The Wines of Portugal, is an excellent gateway into that whole world. Can you tell people one more time where they can find the book and find you online as well?
Of course. Well, you can find the book on Amazon, of course, but it's also on my website, which is www.richardmason.com. He's M-A-Y-S-O-N is the spelling of the surname. And on that website, you'll find my book, and you'll find also, lots of tasting notes there as well.
And your other books, Port and the Douro as well, and a book on
Madeira. Yeah, I've got another book, Port and the Douro, and a book on Madeira, the wines and the islands and their wines.
Fantastic. Richard, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Friends, all that information will be linked in our show notes. I look forward to you hopefully paying a visit here to New Orleans when we're all able to travel and be around each other again.
Love to. Thank you, Brian.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Richard. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I will be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends. Happy to have had you here this week. As always, one more show from the end of 2020 to get to after this one on the wines of Portugal. We'll be chatting with another very fine wine author, Jessica Dupuis, who put out a book on the wines of the Southwest United States. It covers the interesting wine producing states that you may not know a heck of a lot about, but Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. And of course, Texas has the longest standing or biggest, I should say, wine industry of those four states mentioned. But there's a lot of really cool things happening. And Jessica has put out a terrific book talking about it. It's actually from the same publishing company that put out Richard's book that you heard about today. So much of the format's the same. A lot of great background information. And then we learn about a lot of wineries. We learn a lot about the varietals and the terroir and so on. It's a really excellent volume, just like this one is. And I want to thank Richard again for the conversation here. I'll get to that one more thing on that in just a second. But yes, we held this show, as you know, to be part of the relaunch of the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, part of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And you can go to southernfood.org, look at the top of the website, and you will see a media tab, and then you'll see the podcast network. And it is a growing, ever-growing network of podcasts. There you go. That's why we call it a podcast network. Huh? Go figure. But a lot of great shows on there. Well, you know, 2-3 great shows on there now, and we'll have a few more being added consistently as we move forward. So I encourage you to check that out. Check out some of our shows that we rolled out with the relaunch of the network. And again, after the shows on the Wines of the Southwest coming up next in just a couple days, we'll have that out to you. We'll be on to our new shows recorded here in 2021. But I do want you to encourage you to go visit Richard's website and find The Wines of Portugal. You can buy it online there. It's a really, really fine book. And if you don't know, you gathered all this, and we talked about this during the conversation, a lot of great wines coming out of Portugal, and a lot of them represent a terrific value compared to a lot of the wines that come out of the old world and out of Europe. It's a really interesting country to discover. It's very diverse in its wine production, as we noted in this conversation. Lots of great white wines, which maybe a lot of you don't know. Of course, we know the Port and Madeira, probably. A lot of terrific red wines. Really, really interesting stuff going on. And again, pretty easy on the pocketbook. So go pick up Richard's book here on the wines of Portugal, because really it's a fantastic way. It's great if you're going to visit Portugal, and I would say it's indispensable if you're going to go do wine tourism in Portugal, but it's also super valuable if you're just on the hunt for good Portuguese wines wherever you are. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.